Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we catch up with a bunch of openings that we missed over the last few weeks while we've been gone. Michael talks about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Peter and Michael also talk about The Heiress, Annie, and The Performers. So you're going to want to listen to that as well. Thanks so much, and welcome back.
You might say that I'm square, but damn, I come alive. The city's bright as a penny arcade. It blinks, it tilts, it rings.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Thursday, November 15th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this evening, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer who you could read at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, at Critcherland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You could see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see his photography at TrafalgarSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So I want to welcome everybody back.
Yes.
We've been gone for a few weeks, and it's been a crazy couple of weeks, and mostly due to our absence has been due to my lack of electricity at both my home and my office, and some considerable storm damage at my house.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, we had some flooding, but... But, you know, it was, you know, having no electricity and no internet for a couple of weeks is really humbling at best. And but we received so many nice notes from listeners wondering where we were and how we're doing. And I want to let everybody know that it's seemingly everything on my side is good. We're all happy and healthy. And and Michael and Peter and I talked a bunch of times throughout the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. In fact, we actually were going to try to do a podcast the evening of Hurricane Sandy because I really didn't think it was going to be that bad. And just about 2 hours before we were to record, we lost electricity. So we're back now. It's Thursday evening, and we're going to try to do a catch-up show and catch up on a bunch of the things we missed in the last couple of weeks quickly. And we're going to try to get back onto our Sunday routine, so we will record again in a few days. So let's start off this this evening with Virginia Woolf. Last time that we talked, which was, let's see, October 21st, Peter had seen Virginia Woolf, but Michael had not yet. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what you thought about it?
Well, I really just wanted to basically echo everything that Peter said and say it's a very, very strong production, extremely well done. I think, you know, how lucky we are and to have had two such superb revivals of Virginia Woolf in not that long, you know, a period of time. The last one with Kathleen Turner and Bill Irwin, et cetera, I thought was so excellent. I never thought I would ever see a production as good. And I would say this one is equally as good, just very, well, not very different, but different in significant ways. And just points up the richness of the play. And as we discussed last time, as Peter discussed, how different interpretations can bring out different colors in the play, which really is one of the masterworks of the modern theater. You know, I mean, it's we can't state that often enough. It's just Albee's supreme achievement, in my opinion, and I think it has a very, very solid place in the pantheon. I think almost everyone would agree with that. So yes, bravo to director Pam McKinnon. I would mention first of all, because lately I have seen too many revivals of plays that I feel have been undone by the direction, and this is quite the opposite case. I think she did a brilliant job of it. And Tracy Letts is just as brilliant as everyone has said in the role of George. I didn't find that his performance was so much of a revelation in terms of I didn't think it was such a glaringly different interpretation as some people seem to think. But to me, it was brilliant just because it was so well acted. And he, I think he was one of the, I do think he was one of the more masculine, quote unquote, Georges that I've seen. And that did make a significant difference in the dynamic with him and Martha. And conversely, Amy Morton was, as Peter and others have pointed out, not the, not the Gorgon, not the, the Harridan, that she often has been in the past. So it really was very interesting how that those changes affected the play, but it's still, you know, it's still Virginia Woolf, and it still makes the same points that it always did. So bravo to them. Also Madison Dirks as Nick, who was looked a little older than I thought the character is supposed to be, and also maybe was not quite as spectacularly good looking as some past Nicks, but again the acting was so excellent that he I thought he was really terrific. He also had to me a very I guess a patrician quality that seemed very appropriate. And Carrie Coon as Honey, although I did think on the one hand it occurred to me, and someone else had mentioned to me, that it seemed like she was drunker from the early parts of the play than some other honeys have been, and I thought maybe that wasn't the best choice. But on the other hand, you know, these people, they arrive at George and Martha's house at I believe 2 a.m. and they have already come from another party where there was presumably tremendous amounts of drinking going on there. And then as soon as they get to George and Martha's, they start to, you know, hoist several during the course of that. So certainly from a realistic standpoint, it's very justifiable that she would be quite drunk from the beginning. Really, don't miss this if you can. It's just as good as the reviews have told you that it is.
Well, a double endorsement. So I guess we all know what we have to do. So Will, the next show up, which is The Heiress, which opened on November 1st two weeks ago, at the Walter Kerr. Peter, why don't you start us off? Will The Heiress get the double endorsement as well?
I'll do my part. This is a marvelous play. Every time I see it, I'm reminded of that. I somehow tend to forget, and I think it's because the two authors, Ruth and Augustus Getz, aren't famous. You know, this is their play that made it, and I don't know that they had any other hits. But they certainly had a success with this one. And what's so fascinating about the history of this play is that it opened in Boston on January of 1947 under the title Washington Square, because that's what it's an adaptation of, Henry James Washington Square, about Catherine, the plain girl, who's made to seem more plain than she is by her father. He has done a job on her because he is still resentful that his wife died delivering her, and he's never gotten over that. So the girl cannot possibly live up to her mother, who has been idealized by the father. She may have been terrific, the mother, don't misunderstand me, but death improves people, you know, and as a result, he's just crazy about the wife and therefore not as crazy about his daughter. And therefore, when a fortune hunter named Morris comes around, he can see nothing but the fortune hunter. And what's really nice is Dan Stevens here really makes you wonder if he's on the level or not. I mean, in many productions, it's a little more opaque, but he keeps you guessing. He seems reasonably sincere, but maybe he's just a good actor. He's a good actor as Dan Stevens, but maybe he's a good actor as Morris, too. A lot of people said, gee, I can't see Jessica Chastain in this part because she's not plain looking, and yet she makes herself look plain, especially in profile. So I found this a very effective production. Unfortunately, everybody compares it to what happened 16 or so years ago when Cherry Jones did the part. She's one of our greatest actresses, no question. But I think this is a really game try, and given the fact that a lot of people don't know this play, I urge them to see it. Now, Washington Square, when it opened in 47 in Boston, closed there after 1 week. 1 week. That was it. And yet it opened that September under new management, new cast on Broadway, and ran a year. And then ran a year in London. Oh, no, ran a year and a half in London, in fact. And then became a film that got nominated for an Oscar and is won an Oscar for Olivia de Havilland. So I think this is an interesting metaphor for the play, because what it's essentially saying is, you know, you think somebody is down and out, and the person can rise like a phoenix, just as this play did. So David Strathern does a very nice job as the father. And I will admit, you're going to enjoy this production much more if you hadn't seen the other one. Still, the play crackles. Almost every line of dialogue counts so much, especially the father. The father really comes up with some damn good lines you see his thought processes, and I mean, he is who he is, and it just comes across through every line of dialogue. And the way Jessica Chastain makes this character grow into something we might not want her to grow into, all very fascinating. I had a very good time at it.
Well, so, Michael, are you going to uphold your end of the bargain here?
Yes and no. I absolutely agree about the play. I think it's a masterpiece of the type of play that it is. By the way, I just checked IMDb, and in fact, the screenplay for the famous, wonderful film version with Olivia de Havilland and Montgomery Clift and Ralph Richardson and Miriam Hopkins is credited to Ruth and Augustus Getz only. I mean, as far as the
oh, I see.
Yeah. And also, of course, Henry James. No one was brought in. And I think they were smart enough to realize that that was the right thing to do, because they really knew what they were doing. It's spectacularly well crafted, so much so that I think it's still extremely effective in this production, which is one of the revivals I referred to earlier, which is not at all well directed by Moises Kaufman. There are just innumerable moments that are miscalculated, and I can't even begin to catalog them for you. I also thought that there wasn't, although I thought Jessica Chastain had many wonderful moments, I didn't think that the arc of her character was that clear. And although David Strathairn, I believe it's pronounced Strathairn, by the way, Peter.
Okay.
I may be wrong. I liked him best of the three. Dan Stevens, I have not seen him in Isn't It Downton Abbey that he's in?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone? Yeah. I think that's what he's in. And he is British. I will credit him greatly with doing a perfect American accent. I would never have known that he was British. But on the other hand, to me, there was something very contemporary, very modern about his speech and his body language. And that really took me out of it. I can't quite put my finger on it, but he did not seem to me like someone of that time period. And what else? The set was lovely to look at, but as many people have pointed out, the staircase would not... Well, oh, this is an interesting point that I have to add to this. I actually worked in a building that is either that exact house or the mirror image of it. There are on Washington Square North, there are several townhouses that are basically mirror images of themselves. And I worked in one of them, and the film was filmed in one of them. I'm not sure which one exactly. So that it's always kind of amazing to me to see the movie of the heiress. But this one, you know, the staircase should not come down into the middle of the living room like that. I just don't think that happened, and it certainly doesn't happen in any of these actual homes. And the other thing with the staircase is that the way it was staged, the very, very climactic moment at the very end of the play, when Catherine walks up the stairs, she was walking, you know, and she was facing upstage. So I don't think that was a very good idea at all. So I think that the sets could have been rethought a little bit more. It's Derek McLean, by the way. And again, lots of little infelicities in staging. And to me, if you have actors who have several wonderful moments, but the entire performance doesn't cohere, that's a sign that it's the director at fault. It's sometimes difficult to tell exactly where, you know, what is the responsibility of the director and what is the responsibility of the actors. But that's a yardstick that I use, and I think that usually is a good one. I did love Judith Ivy very much as Aunt Pennyman, and I have to give a shout out to, excuse me just a second, I guess it was, oh, wait a minute, yeah. I'm sorry. I guess Caitlin O'Connell in the role of Morris's sister. Is that right,
mm-hmm. Peter? Well, certainly there is a Morris's sister. I don't know if that's who played it.
I'm a little confused on the character names. Is that Mrs. Montgomery or is it?
Yeah. Elvis?
Oh, Mrs. All right. Then I'm sorry. Then it's Dee Nelson. She was really wonderful. I thought some people had much more of a period feel than others, and she was one of them. So that's what I thought. I thought that the play overcame some really not very good direction at all.
Well, I'll tell you about that staircase. I will say what I noticed about the staircase more than anything else is the way Jessica Chastain came down it. And the moment she saw her father in the room, she stopped on the stairs. She was blithely running down. She was perfectly happy until she got to that point, seemingly not to have a care in the world. But once she saw him, she blanched, she stopped. And when she resumed her descent, she walked more guardedly, as if she knew that the closer she got to him, the closer she'd be to confronting her fears. That's what I liked. Even when she went to kiss him, she stopped for a second because she's afraid she's even going to do that wrong. You know, when he expresses even the most vague disapproval,
yeah,
her head falls forward as if it's guillotined. You know, so I like that very much about her performance, and I think that's really top notch. And yes, I agree. David Strat, give me the pronunciation.
Strathairn.
Okay. When he goes into his heavy artillery of saying you lack beauty, you lack grace, you lack charm, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's his truth. That's only his opinion. You know, he thinks he's telling her for her own good, you know, that type of thing. And it reminds me of a line in Cactus Flower, a very different play, I'll grant you. When people hurt your feelings, they always say they're doing it for your own good.
Well, it's kind of like, isn't it kind of also like The Rainmaker in 110 in the Shade?
Sure.
The way they keep telling Lizzie that she's playing. And by the way, I always find that interesting because there aren't too many of those characters, but there is, well, these two. There's Lizzie in The Rainmaker and 110 in the Shade.
Sure.
And there's Catherine in The Heiress. Mm-hmm. And they are, it's interesting. They go out of their way, it seems to me, to cast actresses who are by no means plain. You know, and if anything, many times they're the opposite because they want to you know, they don't want, well, I mean, I guess there's lots of reasons why they do that, but the idea of casting an actress who is actually playing in those roles might be very freighted. you know.
It's and funny also, to say this because, yeah, I just brought up Cactus Flower for a very different reason. But okay. You may recall in William Goldman's book, The Season, he talks about this issue, saying the fact that you cannot have somebody truly homely on stage playing a homely person because it's just too much for the audience to take. And that's why, you know, Lauren Bacall was, at least in 1965, quite stunning. And and as a result, you know, there she is made to look plain, but everybody knew she wasn't plain, and everybody could relax that the moment would come into play when she really looked good, you know. So, but that's one of the points he makes in that wonderful book, The Season.
Well, I didn't know he said that, but I think that's absolutely spot on with that, as he was with so many things. and yes, I did like David Strathairn very much. He to me has a wonderful period quality that, as I said, some of the others didn't have. So I enjoyed him very much.
Alrighty. So the heiress gets added to the list. maybe these will be good Christmas presents, perhaps, for people on your list.
Yep.
But, you know, the sun will come out tomorrow, won't it now?
It sure will.
So we had another opening on November 8th, which was, of course, the revival of Annie. Both Peter and Michael got a chance to see this. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that one? Oh, no.
Oh, when they hesitate. You know, Michael, you know what they say. If you see something, say something. So go ahead.
I just thought it was incredibly poorly directed, and I cannot believe that James Lapine was given the assignment in the first place, and I do not understand on what basis that happened. I don't know what anyone looked at in James Lapine's history to think that he could direct Annie. The only thing I can possibly think of is, I suppose, maybe one could argue that the first act of Into the Woods is something like the kind of humor and sensibility that's required for this. But I was incredibly dispirited and disappointed. They missed laugh after laugh after laugh after laugh. And I felt that several people on stage were completely at sea, most notably Katie Finneran as Miss Hannigan. And also the woman who played Grace Farrell, who Grace Farrell is not supposed to be tremendously cold and nasty. It doesn't really work that way. And Katie Finneran, I don't know what she was doing, but she just, you know, as I've said. Maybe even on this podcast before, I think the biggest laugh I ever heard in my life on Broadway was in the original production of Annie, at the end of You're Never Fully Dressed Without a Smile. It's, first of all, the song itself is a showstopper. It's a great melody. The staging was brilliant. It's the first time you really see the orphans happy. You know, they're just joyful listening to this radio broadcast and making fun of it and doing all kinds of goofy choreography. And, you know, it ended and the orchestra does the ride out and the audience just was in ecstasy and applauded for, you know, it seemed like forever. And Dorothy Loudon came out and she stood, and waited for the ovation to die. Sure. And then she said, "Do I hear happiness in here?" And I swear to God, the roof came off of the Alvin Theater and people, I mean, it seemed like people laughed for 5 minutes. It probably was just 1 minute. In this production, Katie Finneran says the same line and it gets a laugh that lasts about 4 seconds. So I don't know what to say. I can't I'm a little surprised that it could be screwed up that severely by this director who should never have been allowed anywhere near this production. And that makes two incredibly unfortunate, very, very badly directed revivals of Annie. The last one was with Nell Carter, directed by Martin Charnin, who wrote it, but apparently didn't know how to direct it. What else do I have to say about this? There weren't enough orphans in it. The set design had the orphanage taking up only about half of the stage at most, and so it seemed very, very, very cramped, and not in a good way. It just seemed like they didn't have hardly enough room to move, let alone dance. Let's see. I guess that's mostly what I have to. I felt that Leela Crawford was kind of robotic, didn't have a lot of charm in the title role, and also her voice is very strong, but not very lyrical. So she was good in the places where she had to belt, but not so much in the other places. Points for her New York accent, though. I do think that she did that very well, and I actually thought that was a very good choice for the character. I also like Clark Thorell as Rooster. And I liked the sets well enough. And the orchestra sounded nice, nice and large and full. And it's always nice to be in the palace. But I don't know. I could just tell, it seemed to me really that the applause and the laughs were nowhere near what they should have been. And at the end of the show, the audience really seemed appreciative. But while it was happening, it's just not what I'm used to, the kind of response that I'm used to Annie getting from an audience. So I guess I'm in more or less the minority on this one. I think that from what I understand, most of the reviews were positive, although the Times was kind of mixed. I would be much more negative than the Times. I think it's a missed opportunity, and I wish that they had let someone else direct it.
So, Peter, what did you think?
I liked it more than that. I do see flaws too. When Michael says I don't think that they got the laughs, I'll tell you one thing. I thought that Leela Crawford, the little girl playing Annie, didn't get the laughs because her diction is terrible. She's hard to understand.
Yeah.
When she sings, you can understand a lyric, but when she speaks, you cannot understand her. Michael talks about the line that tore down the house back in 1977. I'll bring up one, too. And that's when Annie gets to Daddy Warbucks' mansion for the first time, cannot believe what she's seeing. And Grace nicely says to her, "Annie, what would you like to do first?" And she says, "The floors," because meaning she's good. That's what she thinks she's there for. You know, she can't begin to believe that she's going to be a guest. She really believes she's going to have to work to earn her keep. That was an enormous laugh in 1977. It was a tiny laugh in 2012 because the kid does not speak well. So I think that's an enormous problem with this production. I really believe if I didn't know the show cold, I wouldn't have understood it because of the kid's inability to speak. Michael didn't mention Anthony Wallow, who I thought was marvelous.
I'm sorry, and forgive me. Thank you.
Of course.
As soon as I stopped, I realized. You finish, and then I will.
Okay. he's really quite good, especially being a man who's never been able to show emotion in the past, and now he's learning. And sometimes he comes out with something that's really heartfelt, and then he has an expression on his face of say, "Gee, did I go too far? Am I exposing too much of myself? Is this how you do it when you really let out your feelings?" So there's a lot of wonderful subtext in what he's doing. This is a great star from Australia. He's done a lot of shows there, and he's even a cancer survivor, God love him. And I mean, it's wonderful to see his voice so potent and his performance equally potent. So that was really quite good. I like that quite a bit. Now, I'm not going to disagree with Michael about much of the direction, but I have to point out one thing. All right. My history with Annie goes way back. I was at the final performance of the Goodspeed Opera House in October of 1976. There was no Dorothy Loudon. There was no Little Girls number. That's what I mean. Of course, there were little girls on the scene, but there was no number. There was no "We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover." So they did a lot of work on the show. I think even at the end of the first act, the Marx Brothers showed up. I may be thinking of Sherry, where that happened too. But anyway, they did do a lot of work on it, but I knew it was going to be a hit. Anyway, I loved at the end of the show when they dragged in the box, and oh, they opened the box, it's Christmas, and out comes Sandy, you know, and isn't that wonderful? And you're just so happy, you know, Sandy and Andy are reunited, and that great, and so on and so forth. Well, when it was announced it was coming to Broadway, I ordered tickets for the second official performance because I knew they were going to get raves, and I wanted to go to the second performance because I knew they would just be so thrilled to be in such a big hit, they couldn't wait to do it for us. So I went. When Sandy jumped out of the box then, at that point it occurred to me, how did that dog get there? Nobody's mentioned that dog. I mean, Annie hasn't really mentioned that dog to anybody, not to Hedy Warbucks. How'd they find him? You know, so on and so forth. And James Lapine has at least addressed the issue, because in the middle of the first act, dog catchers are running around trying to catch strays, and Grace Farrell goes up to one of them, and we don't hear a conversation, but she does hand money over to the guy, and we really get the impression she's saying, look, if you find a dog that matches this description, you know, bring him to our house, will you? You know, because the kid lost her dog. I don't think it solves every problem, because I don't know how Grace knows about it either, but at least it makes a little more sense in what was going on there with finding the dog. So I like that very much.
But on the other hand,
go ahead.
But to balance that, did you notice how they totally ran right over that wonderful moment at the end when they're reunited? As I remember it, when he came out originally, well, I mean, you just described it, but here he just kind of walks on while they're singing the right. Final number. There's no moment of reuniting, and it's like, how can they? And P.S. It's a tap number.
You know what that is. You know the choreographer has been highly criticized in this production, and rightfully so. I mean, you never fully dress without a smile, I think, didn't get the reaction with the line that Michael talked about afterwards, because the number was such a disappointment. It's not even choreographed. I don't know what they're doing up there. Choreography is, to me, the weakest element of this production, next to the kid not being able to be understood. But what I realized what was going on in that final number, A New Deal for Christmas, is they were trying to make an 11 o'clock number out of it. And, you know, you can't put a square peg in a round hole, and acorns don't grow from maple trees, as they say in When Pigs Fly. So, about a very different subject. But, the thing is that, you know, they try to make it a show-stopping number, and it's not built for that. So
yes, and they also stupidly changed the exit of Miss Hannigan and Rooster and Lily St. Regis.
Yes.
They rather than being dragged off, they sort of run away into the house somewhere, you know, to the depths of the mansion, and then late the next we see them, they're like sort of being. They're tapping, tap dancing back onto the stage with the cops tap dancing after them.
You know, I wonder how much of this has to do with the British musical. That sounds like a non sequitur. But, you know, we had all those British musicals where there was no dancing at all. And as a result, we lost a generation of choreography passed down and what it should look like. And it seems to me we have a lot of overachievers here. People who mean well, who try to give you as much bang for the buck as you can possibly
right.
get. And as a result, I've seen a lot of over-choreographing in recent years. It certainly was true of the How to Succeed revival, and it's certainly true here.
Right.
So it's very regrettable that we had those years where, and certainly losing Bob Fosse, losing Michael Bennett, losing Michael Kidd for that matter, maybe through age, but nevertheless, losing Tommy Toon essentially, you know, who after 91, you know, has not shown up as a choreographer on Broadway. Not that I know. Is that right? No, I'm sorry. The Best Little Horrors Goes Public counts. Anyway, you get my point that there's been a lot of musical theater that has been choreography free. And Peter Stone used to like to say, the sets do the dancing now. Now, and to a degree, that happens here. The sets dance better than the people do in this production of Annie.
Well, also, you may laugh. You may laugh, but I'm very serious when I say I think that putting a tap number in it has something to do with the Radio City Christmas show and the Rockettes.
Oh, how funny.
In the same way that ridiculous tap number ended up in the version of A Christmas Carol that played at Madison Square Garden for so many years.
Yeah. How interesting. You know,
well, you know, don't you think?
I certainly am not laughing in the sense of laughing out of derision or scorn.
Yeah.
See your point. It may very well be that this is the type of thing people want to see at Christmas time and expect to see at Christmas time. And maybe it'll save them a trip to Radio City. You know, who knows? But
Annie actually went. Did you see? I noticed her putting on her tap shoes. She goes to the steps. And she sits there and she puts on her tap shoes on stage and then she starts tapping.
By the way, I also think, and I'm amazed that Lapine didn't address this, but kid through most of the show has hair that obscures her face a great deal.
Yes.
And it's especially when she's in profile. And again, you know, we need every bit of lip reading prowess we can get for this kid because, I mean, she's just so hard to understand.
I know. It's basic. Didn't I say this a couple of weeks ago? It's basic things. How did these people get hired?
It moved like lightning. I felt I was in the theater 10 minutes. You didn't feel that way.
Well, I suppose the pacing itself, that's true. Yes.
You know, so I'm credit where it's there. You know, I'll grant you that. And one of the things I like, too, about Anthony Wallow, which may have come from direction, but there were times when he was very rough. I don't mean severe, but I mean, like, you could tell that he was that he had grown up, as he has said later in the show. I grew up in Hell's Kitchen, you know, that type of thing. I saw that street background in him.
Yes.
Many times, and I like that very much because it's supported by the text. So I thought that was very good too. I also like the fact that one of the orphans was oversized, a big girl. I don't mean fat; I mean tall.
Right.
And she was the least enthusiastic about Annie's success, which makes sense because, to quote a line from Applause, "God let it happen to me." You know, and I saw that in her. So I thought that was quite nice to have an orphan. You know, it reminded me of that famous Pauline Kael quote about Sound of Music. I'm not going to get it exactly, you know, wasn't there one little Von Trapp kid who didn't want to perform or threw up before a performance? Or, you know, and I mean, really, it's a smart idea to orchestrate the characters of the orphans and not have everybody just so thrilled that Annie's hit it big, you know, I mean. There's got to be some sort of wistfulness, even jealousy, to say the least. And I saw her through the tall girl.
I mean, I see what you're saying, but I guess I would disagree that I don't think that belongs in this kind of a show. And I guess that is what, you know, that is the tack that Lapine took to kind of emphasize the darkness of it, which everyone kind of thought he would do from the beginning, and he sure did. And I think that basically it was a tremendous mistake.
Let me point out that Katie Finneran is my least favorite Broadway performer. I think she's always over the top, and she was here too, but she wasn't nearly as atrocious as I thought she was going to be.
Oh, that's good.
They're not going to put that on the marquee, you know, as a book.
You don't think so?
Nearly as atrocious as I thought she was going to be. She was no good, mind you. And in fact, casting it young is a problem too. It reminded me, I saw Judy Kaye do Sweeney Todd at Paper Mill in 1993. Okay, that's almost 20 years ago now. And the thing was, Judy Kaye was marvelous. Of course, she's Judy Kaye. However, she was too young and too pretty to be Mrs. Lovett, and she wouldn't grab onto this guy thinking it's her last chance. And when you cast Miss Hannigan too young, you have that same problem because she would not think of herself as that desperate yet. On the other hand, let me also credit Lapine for one thing. As much as I don't like the kid's diction, it is very good to cast an older kid as Annie's. Too many productions, and this is even true of Martin Charnin. He would not have Annie if it were not for Martin Charnin. He's the one who thought of it. You know, a lot of people say, oh, Mike Nichols really directed it. Again, I started at good speed. the direction that wound up at the stage of the album was 90% there. And you can say, well, then he put Mike Nichols did the other 10%. I don't necessarily believe that. He may have. Obviously, he gave a hint every now and then of something. But I really believe Tronin directed Annie. Anyway, the thing is, though, as the years have gone on, he's really cast younger and younger and younger kids. And you really need Annie to be a leader. She is the leader of those orphans. You know, there she is in the first scene being mother to those kids, the little girl who wakes up in the dream. The nightmare, you know, all that stuff. You need an older kid, and I was very glad that Lapine picked somebody who looked as if she was supposed to be 10, 11, 12, whatever it is, as opposed to 7 or 8, even.
That was, as you say, a huge misstep of the last revival.
Yeah, it really is. And plenty of others, believe me. Yeah.
All righty. So Annie is a possible... Didn't quite make the list there, but we have a lot more things to take a look at this season. Something that won't be with us is the performers. Peter got a chance to see it. Michael is going to be seeing it Sunday afternoon, but we hear recently tonight that it will be closing. So we thought we'd include it tonight before we wrap up. So Peter, why don't you tell us about the performers?
Well, one thing that interested me is a very famous line from Boys in the Band has been updated here in the performance, because the famous line in Boys in the Band that was outrageous in 1968 was, "Who do you have to fuck to get a drink around here?" Now the line is, "Whose asshole do you have to fist to get a drink around here?" Well, you know, this is the type of play that used to open on Thursday and close on Saturday. I remember saying that when I saw it. And here it is, almost doing exactly that, opening early in the week and closing late in the week. So, well, you know, I mean, all things considered, it's exactly what it wanted to be. It's a commercial Broadway comedy that is a sex farce, and Cheyenne Jackson is marvelous as a dim-witted guy who really knows who he is and knows what he wants. He's an adult porn star. He truly believes that he's doing good work. He really feels so successful in his own world that he doesn't care what the rest of the world thinks. He's very insular in that way. And, you know, you got to please yourself, and he pleases himself. And that's really wonderful to watch. It is really... It may not be a demanding role, but it is a consummate performance for what this show wants to have, needs to have. So there he is. He's this porn star. And I think what motivated this play was that the playwright, David West Reed, found out that in the porn world, having sexual intercourse, having oral intercourse, having anal intercourse, all those things you can do in porn movies, but the one thing you don't do is kiss. And as a result, kissing is reserved for your true love. And as a result, that's what the problem in the play is. He is now kissing one of his co-stars, and his wife is really jealous. She's not jealous that they're doing anything else. She's only jealous that they've kissed, because that is the symbol for true love. And that's really the motor of the play. There's a lot of talk about winning an award, because Cheyenne Jackson is convinced he is going to win the Best Actor of the Year award. We'll see if he does. By the way, take a look at the award. It's subtly outrageous. I think that's a good way of putting it. Also, we have a reuniting here, because as it turned out, Cheyenne Jackson's character named Mandrew, that's a little more butch than Andrew because of the man part of it, is being interviewed by a Post, a New York Post reporter, who we went to school with. They were high school chums, and that's played by Daniel Breaker, and the character's name is Lee, and he's a very different type of person from the porn star. He's a real straight arrow, and his love life gets brought into question, too, because he's been with his high school sweetheart since high school. She's played by Alicia Silverstone, and, you know, really, all things considered, he, being in this world, has to start wondering about his own life, wouldn't he? Sure he would, you know, because you see all this hedonism around you, don't you start having having second thoughts about your own life. So that's a complication. Henry Winkler's there. He's the one who has that nefarious line that I brought up at the beginning of this. He plays Chuck Wood. You know, that does sound like a porn star, doesn't it? Chuck Wood. And it's funny because, you know, Henry Winkler's no kid. You know, I mean, let's face it. I mean, he's got a lot of gray hair, and he's been around for a while. And the idea of him being in contention with Cheyenne Jackson for the same award seems odd in the porn world. Now, I understand that in the Tonys, the Oscars, the Emmys, you know, yes, indeed, old people against young people happens all the time. But wouldn't you think in the world of porn that an older man with gray hair and Henry Winkler, who has a vague resemblance now to Edward Everett Horton, you know, you wouldn't think of as being in a porn movie, but he has a very nice speech at the end about winning an award that is very tender. This is hardly a disgrace, and while one has to wonder if the house I saw it with on Saturday night was papered with shills and admirers and what have you, the audience had a hell of a time. You know, I don't know who paid for the tickets. I don't know who was there, but nevertheless, this was greeted with genuine laughter. And if you really want an undistinguished good time, you should get to the Long Acre by Sunday night. Michael tells me they're closing on Sunday night, not Sunday afternoon. So you have an extra chance.
All righty. So I think that catches us up with what is happening. We will be returning on Sunday. Tonight, Scandalous is opening at the Neil Simon, but we will see in the next week or so if we can cover that as well. We have a full schedule on Sunday as well. We're going to talk about Emotional Creature at Signature. Michael's going to talk about the Encores Gala, and The Tempest, the opera at the Met.
Yes.
A few other things. We're going to talk about some CDs that come out. A reissue of Cabaret, Carols for a Cure, A Christmas Story, Forbidden Broadway's new CD. We'll talk.
And the other big news that came today, which really surprised me.
Yes.
The Yankees thing.
The Yankee story. So we'll talk about the Yankees, the musical, exclamation point.
It's not a musical.
But they always have to put a musical exclamation point on the end.
You know, I did a study of that, and that's highly overrated. I'll find my statistics on that. You'd be amazed how few musicals have had exclamation points over the years. It's not nearly as rampant as you'd think. I did a study after Gurney did a play at 59th. I don't remember what the play was, but he talked about a musical version of the Cherry Orchard called Cherry! Exclamation point. And I said, let me see. You know, that's an easy thing to go to. You know, it's the way that musicals are criticized as being lightweight more than any other way. And it's not as true as you think. So anyway, maybe for next time we'll talk about that too.
Well, I forget which one it was. It may have even have been Oklahoma, but somebody joked that the exclamation point was added out of desperation.
Yes, that has been said. Yes.
In that case, it worked out quite well. But absolutely. but I guess Peter, I don't know if you did this study also, but it would be interesting to see which of those with exclamation points, what percentage of them were successful and which ones were flops. And just as a point of interest, Scandalous has one.
It does. Right. We should do a exclamation point to flop ratio.
Okay. See what I can find.
All right. So if you, the listener, if you're still with us after our hurricanes, if you would like to reach out and touch us and weigh in on your favorite exclamation point musical lists, perhaps you can go to BroadwayRadio.com. There's contact information for Peter, Michael, and me there. That way you can email us or give us a call or leave us a voicemail. Check out our Twitter and Facebook pages or, you know, all sorts of other things there. Also, you can find links to the stories that we talk about on those pages there at BroadwayRadio.com. And also subscribe to Broader Radio. You can get us, listen to us in iTunes or various other ways. The iTunes subscribe button is there on the page as well. But you can listen to us in Stitcher or on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So until Sunday, and we'll be back very relatively quickly, this is James Marino on behalf of Peter Flish and Michael Portantier saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks so much.
Orville needed his brother, or else
he'd go
kerplop. To feel that feeling of power. Now every other need has disappeared from view.